You're listening to KBFR 95.3 FM, and this is ZT, and I am talking today with Professor Susan Erickson, and she is a cultural anthropologist who has some experience in reproductive technology. That's correct?
Yes, it is.
Okay. And I thought she would be a very good person to talk to about cloning and issues surrounding cloning, which is what we're going to be talking about today, since it's been in the news, at least a little bit recently, with the Raelians. And the first thing that I thought was kind of important was the distinction between therapeutic cloning and reproductive cloning. Because, I don't know, one of them sort of gives the other a bad name, just because, I don't know, kind of thrown into pod together, I guess. So, can you tell us a little bit about the difference between the two and maybe what therapeutic cloning is used for?
Right. So, ZT, you're absolutely right about the fact that it gets conflated a lot. It's assumed to be the same thing. And there's the kind of cloning, it's the scientific process that would produce a human being. And then there's the kind of cloning that's called therapeutic cloning, and that's actually used to create a kind of cell that would be used to cure somebody of some kind of illness or disease.
And those are stem cells, right?
Right. So both processes start with an egg, and the DNA of that egg is sucked out, basically, and then the DNA from a single source is put back into the cell. Now, in the case of therapeutic cloning, the single source of the DNA would be a healthy cell, a healthy cardiac cell, a healthy nerve cell that would then be used to cure somebody who has cells that are sick or diseased of that type. In the case of human cloning, that the single source DNA would then be injected back into the egg and stimulated either electrically or with some kind of chemicals to get it to reproduce on its own with the intention of developing an embryo that could then be inserted into the uterus of a surrogate mother or woman, and then with the intention of it developing into a fetus and then later a child.
And that's a circle of life. So the stem cells are interesting because they're at a point in, I guess you could say, after conception. Is that the right way to phrase it? Before they've actually become a kind of cell that's a skin cell or a nerve cell, right?
Mm-hmm. So typically we have, our zygotes are made up of the chromosomes from two people. Mm-hmm. Our mother and our father. And what happens when a sperm and an egg come together is they come together, they fertilize, they start to replicate. And it's in those initial replications that we get stem cells. And those cells can become anything. They can become, they have the blueprint for the entire body. Mm-hmm. And they don't differentiate until after the first couple of divisions. But if you catch those cells in the early divisions, then they can become anything, and that's why they're so valuable, and that they can become a human being, as we talked about, or they can become a differentiated cell if you put the DNA of a differentiated cell for skin or mm-hmm. cardiac cells or nerve cells. They can become anything, and that's where the therapeutic and curative part comes in.
Okay. So at least people know that therapeutic cloning is very, very different from reproductive cloning.
And scientists who are working on issues of therapeutic cloning, of course, get quite upset when it gets conflated, so that the kinds of things that the Raelians are doing and the bad press that they're giving to cloning, more generally speaking, is problematic for the scientists who are trying to develop therapeutic cloning that would cure people of certain diseases.
Right. Okay. So just to do maybe a little background on the Raelians for people who don't know. Rael, the founder of the Raelians, his mother was abducted by aliens in 1945. Is that right?
Yes, that Rael believes that on December 25th, Christmas Day, 45, extraterrestrials took his mom into their UFO to inseminate her in order to produce him. And he believes that he is their final prophet. He was born in 1946.
It's almost like a virgin birth.
Of a sort, yes.
Of a sort. Okay. And the Raelians have obviously said that they've cloned a human being, and we still don't know for sure yet, right? But what I'm a little bit more concerned about is all the other social implications of cloning, right? And one of the things that's happened in the United States and in a few countries in Europe has been wrongful life and wrongful birth suits.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where either children sue their parents or the family sues a doctor for because they let a child be born who had a defect. Or is that correct?
Mm-hmm. That's right. So since the mid-80s, there's been a legal precedent established that either a child can sue his or her parents or parents can sue their physician for wrongful birth or wrongful life. And that's a legal category that exists so that there's an obligation. The assumption is that there's an obligation on the part of the physician to have told, in the case of the parents bringing the suit against a physician, the physician was obliged to provide prenatal testing that would give people, parents, the opportunity then to abort ahead of time a child that had been diagnosed with genetic anomalies of some sort. Now, in the case where children are bringing these suits against their parents, and this is a newer category of wrongful birth, the child can bring the suit for having been born at all.
I see.
And so you can imagine in the case of clones, who knows? Yeah. Maybe they'll say, you know what, I really didn't want to start out with your DNA, Dad, because, well...
kind of brings a whole new meaning to the phrase, I never wanted to be born, or I wish I wasn't.
Exactly.
Right. What are some of the aspects that cloning brings up as far as sort of new paradigms of discrimination goes?
I think it's a really excellent question, this idea of new paradigms of discrimination. And, I mean, some of it we're seeing already with regards to, genetic proclivities, so that insurance companies then can say that you have a pre-existing condition. So perhaps, all of this is really speculative at this point because we don't have a cloned population on which to do any kind of research, but it's really easy to imagine as we watch the insurance companies what the kind of havoc that they wreak with the information that's being rendered from the Human Genome Project, that they might take the proclivities we would probably be able to discern among a cloned population of people for certain conditions and then discriminate and not feel obliged to provide insurance for those people that have those certain kind of genetic conditions. That would extend also probably to employment discrimination, or conceivably you can imagine that somebody might say, I don't want to work with somebody who's been cloned, or also the kind of, we can also imagine social discrimination and people not wanting to live perhaps in the same neighborhoods as people who are cloned, not wanting to belong to the same kinds of groups as people who have been cloned. And then there's also the more, because clones, of course, won't necessarily be able to be identified just by looking at them, but perhaps there'll be some kind of moral obligation on the part of clones themselves once they come of age of sexual activity, that just like today where someone who is HIV positive or has some kind of STD needs to, has a moral obligation to confess prior to having sex that they have, they're HIV positive or they have herpes or whatever, you know, they'll have to admit you're having sex with a clone. Who knows? Who knows?
Who knows? One thing that just kind of now occurred to me is that there would actually be a lot of people who are interested, probably be interested in cloning for security reasons. Because I guess if you're a perfect clone, your fingerprints will be exactly the same. Your retina will be exactly the same. Your blood and I guess all of that will be exactly the same. So theoretically, it might be possible for a clone to pass off as someone else, just, you know,
You know, I have to say, I'm not sure that that's true, because when you think of twins, they, of course, start with the same DNA, but I don't think they have the same fingerprints. Hmm. So you can imagine that, you know, the environment. I mean, the other assumption, too, that I think we need to talk about a little bit with regards to cloning is that the person will come out looking exactly like your clone, ZT, would look exactly like you. Well, maybe, maybe not. Would they, if they didn't eat the same food, if they didn't grow up in, you know, the same kind of urban, rural, or suburban environment that you grew up in? There are a lot. The environment has a lot to do with how DNA gets expressed in a particular human being. So. Hmm. We can't make those assumptions. And then as far as fingerprint, fingerprints, we already know that twins don't have the same fingerprints. And I'm imagining, although I've never read into this, but I'm imagining that their retina and all those high tech ways of identifying somebody, that those wouldn't be the same either.
Oh, good. One less thing for me to worry about then, if someone clones me. I guess you saw Star Trek Nemesis recently?
I did. I saw it last night.
And that's interesting because Jean-Luc Picard is cloned.
He is.
Yeah. And he ends up killing his clone.
Yes, he ends up killing his clone and, of course, then being paralyzed and putting the entire Federation at risk. Because he's unable to act because he realizes that he's actually killed himself. There's that one moment and he needs to be rescued, of course, by Data. And it's all very exciting ending.
Oh. Didn't give too much of it away, I guess.
Well, I hope not for you Trekkies out there.
You know, that is kind of interesting because that's at least the first movie, except maybe Gattaca, that I can think of that actually deals with anything kind of close to cloning.
Well, Arnold Schwarzenegger also has a film, The Sixth Day.
Okay, I didn't see that.
And there's a couple of interesting sequences. One is the repet sequence where you can actually... In this particular film, you see Arnold going into a mall in order to repet his pet, who just died that day. And they have memory chips so that they remember all the old tricks that that the dog that died knew, so that there's very little distinction between. But, of course, as we actually know, because there was the cat that was cloned, and she had very different markings on her fur, and she did not come out exactly like the cat that she was cloned from. But the other interesting sequence in the Arnold movie was with regards to, it was in the future, and there was a total ban on cloning, except that one congressman was, his son was dying, and he wanted to circumvent the ban in order to save his son. Mm-hmm. So it seemed to me to be a fairly believable scenario, at any rate, before all the guns came out, you know.
Right.
And the chases and all that kind of thing. But this, you can really see the scenario playing out in a similar way, where it's people with power will have access, regardless of any kind of government ban on any of these processes, because they can afford it or they have the political clout to have these kinds of things done for themselves or their children.
And that's sort of another interesting point, because and correct me if I'm wrong, the Raelians eventually want to get to some point where they can sort of download someone's memories so they can sort of be immortal. Is that right, or am I?
I think by intention they'd like to be able to do that. At this stage, it's really very difficult to imagine how that might happen. How in the world would you download either? In Arnold's scenario, a dog's memory or a human memory. It's such an... I think we just know so little about human memory and all of those different neurons work together to trigger certain memories, the way in which smell interacts to trigger memory. There's so much that we don't know about that. At this point in the science of it, it seems... for me, it seems rather inconceivable you'd ever be able to download memory the way you can download a hard drive of a computer.
Because it would be sort of an interesting ethical question. I mean, if someone made a perfect clone of you and then they took your memory and then they put it in this new person, if you can really say that you're immortal, if you're just sort of, I don't know, sort of very poorly recycled, something like that.
Well, I mean, when you really think about that, what would that be like to have another person with your memory around? I mean, I think it could be conceivably quite ghastly, because even people with the same memory won't necessarily, or the same education won't necessarily make the same decisions.
That's true.
What kind of control would a person want or need to have over his or her clone? And I mean, the psychological and emotional implications of all that, I think, are really interesting to think about.
You know, I guess I was wrong. There's the Star Wars movie, The Clone Wars.
Uh-huh, right.
All right, yeah.
Yeah.
Obviously, there's a lot of ethical problems, right? Someone could conceivably create an army of clones, right? What do you think is the, at least, you know, from what we know now, what kind of federal regulation or what kind of government regulation do you think we should have? And I'm not expecting you to have a complete answer, but I was just wondering if you could speak to that at all.
Well, the FDA has stepped up to the plate in order to assert its authority over any cloned entity. Now, whether or not they're actually going to be able to assert any kind of authority or be able to enforce their authority, it remains to be seen. As for whether or not we need government regulation, oh, that's a really tough one considering the current administration. you know, another piece of this, of course, is that it's eggs from women, so that, and there's the whole piece about women's reproductive freedom and
right.
The ways in which women's bodies get regulated or attempt to get regulated all the time. And the fact that kind of the raw materials for these processes are actually the eggs from women's bodies, plus the fact that although there have been some attempts to create artificial wombs, what's more likely is that there need to be a lot of women who would serve as surrogate mothers for implantation of the embryos, and then not all of those implantations would actually work out. And so there'd be another set of women from that larger set that would then bring a baby to term. So regulating women's bodies is always complicated.
Right. And it's actually a not a very pleasant process for women to have an egg extracted.
No, it's really not. Yeah. I actually have seen these extractions, or harvests, as they're called, in the hospitals. And it involves a very long needle, usually at the end of an ultrasound transducer that's inserted into a woman's vagina. And the needle goes up into the ovary, and then the eggs are fleshed out through this hollow needle.
Wow.
Not to mention all the hormones that actually a woman needs to take in order to get her ovaries to overproduce, hyperproduce the number of eggs that are desirable for any given harvest.
Isn't it, aren't women born with a certain number of eggs?
Mm-hmm.
And then they just, the hormones make them ovulate, or?
Uh-huh, so that
okay.
More of them are available for harvest. So that, you know, typically a woman's body will, once a month, an egg gets released, sometimes two, but not usually many more than that. But an ideal harvest is the harvesting of anywhere between 12 to 20 eggs at a time.
Okay. At least that's more than one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, but to get a woman's body to do that, that's a lot of hormones. And it's uncomfortable for most women.
That doesn't sound very fun.
Mm.
Yeah.
But it does raise the other issue of who exactly will be the women that will do this. Will, you know, the same kinds of issues that have been raised with regards to surrogate mothers. Is it poor women having babies for rich women? Will it be poor women who are taking these hormones and producing these eggs for some kind of better endowed or better financed couple that wants to clone themselves? Or mm-hmm. There's all kinds of ethical issues, I think, on that level.
Hmm. Because it does take something like, isn't it $10,000 or so dollars to do an egg extraction
mm-hmm.
at this point? Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a very expensive procedure.
It actually depends, you know, on who's doing the work. You know, there was a big furor when there were a couple took out ads in Ivy League newspapers. and they offered $50,000 for the eggs of an Ivy League woman.
That wasn't for cloning. That was just for...
That was just actually for IVF purposes, in vitro fertilization purposes.
Okay. I guess that sort of brings up the financial aspects of cloning. I know there's a lot of companies that do very, very bad things now. If in the future, do you see companies sort of taking advantage of this technology and doing unethical things with it? I don't know. I'm just wondering.
Without question. I mean, I think that one of the important pieces to recognize with all of this is that in our system, capitalist processes undergird or support the kind of scientific research that needs to happen, so that even if they're not successful, people who are interested in cloning either themselves or someone else know to go to the Raelians or know to go to the Italian reproductive doctor. He actually has a big clinic. Oh. And I understand that he's gotten an increase in business since he too has said that he is in the process of cloning a human being. So it's definitely a money-making kind of venture. And then, of course, if a human is successfully cloned, people will pay for people with the means will and the intention will pay exorbitant amounts to achieve that. So there's definitely a profit motive in here. What would happen if we do figure out the science of cloning, of human cloning, reproductive cloning, and then we develop? We notice that a lot of the babies that are being born, in fact, have developmental disabilities of some kind, and that's just considered, to use an Arnold word, collateral damage for this process. But we're left with living, breathing human beings that have particular limitations with regards to their physical and perhaps mental well-being that we, because of our science, brought about. And maybe the science will evolve to a point where we'll somehow be able to circumvent that, but probably not completely. And what about that deliberate, the cost of bringing this to being, the social costs, what that means, to bring into being children that will have developmental disabilities? What does that mean for the disability community as well? You know, disability scholars are really weighing in quite heavily. Disability study scholars are weighing in quite heavily on this issue of what cloning means for them as a population. The issue of selective abortion is a complicated one for them because so many of them believe in choice and yet also feel that selective abortion is an insult to them as members of the disability community. I mean, these kinds of problems aren't going to go away. In fact, they'll be exacerbated by the practice of cloning. Collateral damage, I think, is a term that gets used, or it's assumed. It's assumed medically all the time. It's assumed in when we're talking about people being vaccinated for smallpox, that some people are going to die or be disabled by the immunization process itself. And I think that in the processes of cloning, initially the assumption is, and this is how scientists and others are thinking of what will happen to the disabled, that the disabled are collateral damage. I simply want to clarify that I personally do not think of the disabled as falling into that category. I actually think that to be disabled will become more complicated as we play with these technologies that then make knowing ahead of time whether or not a child will be born with some kind of a genetic anomaly, it's going to make the whole process that much more complicated because prenatal selection of fetuses that are diagnosed with any kind of genetic anomaly is already happening. And with these reproductive technologies, including cloning, it's just going to make this selection process more possible. There are going to be more ways to select. And this has certain implications for society that I don't think we've yet realized. We certainly haven't thought through enough. It's very complicated in terms of disability. So that's just a clarification I need to make.
So we've seen in some of the other clones, a Dolly mm-hmm. was one of them, the sheep. She had some problems.
Yeah, she has arthritis. She's prone to obesity. She has successfully reproduced, which is one of the criteria that is generally held out there for mammals, is for a mammal to be able to successfully reproduce is considered a measure of success of them as a mammal. There are, of course, experiments that have been done that create a live being, but they cannot necessarily reproduce.
Mm-hmm.
So Dolly has successfully reproduced, and so that has been a measure of her success. But she also does have these other genetic anomalies as a sheep.
In the United States, at least, most of, I guess, the way I've heard people talking about this is that cloning is another kind of reproductive choice.
Uh-huh.
So if you're pro-choice, maybe you'd be pro-cloning, right? But I guess that's not quite the case in the rest of the world. For instance, Germany, who is more of a pro-choice nation than the United States, is more against cloning. Is that correct, or am I?
Well, you know, I think the way you're talking about it is very illustrative, because we have a tendency when we think about reproductive freedom to immediately assume that the issue is always about abortion, or somehow link it to abortion.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not so sure that they're so closely connected in Germany. Germany actually has the most prohibitive reproductive technology laws in the world with regards to what people can or cannot do. For example, if you conceive a child by in vitro fertilization in the United States, that is where a sperm and an egg come together in a petri dish and then are inserted into a woman's uterus, you can insert as many fertilized eggs as you want in the United States, which leads to then multiple births, which then often leads to selective abortion as a result. Because when a woman is pregnant, as we know with a lot of babies, there's a higher chance that the babies will be born with some kind of developmental problem. It's just very difficult for a lot of babies to grow in the womb at a single time.
Mm-hmm.
But in Germany, they have a limit as to only, they allow a maximum of 3 fertilized eggs to be inserted into a woman's uterus at any one time. So there's only a chance of triplets, because they're regulating in a way that we don't regulate here. They don't want women to have to make this choice.
Mm-hmm.
Not that selective abortion doesn't happen when all 3 eggs implant and start to grow in a woman's uterus, but it's much less of an issue there because they've opted to regulate.
So what other countries are there that have already enacted some sort of legislation about reproductive cloning?
Well, I don't know of all of them, and I don't know how current my information is either, but
okay.
Canada and France and Germany have banned it. Italy, to a certain extent, although, of course, there is that Italian, he's former Italian, now he's practicing in the United States, reproductive physician, scientist. So different countries are approaching it in different ways.
I see.
Okay, you know, there's also the issue of global reproductive tourism, and people have actually made the move for a global ban on cloning, so that a person who lives in a country where cloning is perhaps outlawed or banned would be able to simply hop on a plane and go have it done legally elsewhere.
Sort of like going across state lines to have an abortion.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Okay, that makes sense. In the United States, do you feel as if we don't take the lead in this technology, or if we sort of legislate against it and let it slip by, that other countries will pick up the ball and they'll be doing research in cloning and they'll be making cloned human beings, and entities and corporations will develop in those countries that people will be going to? And how do you feel that a decision like that would impact the United States, or do you feel that that's the case in the United States?
I do think that was part of the argument that prompted, you know, the business aspect,
mm-hmm.
The profit-making aspect was part of the argument that prompted George Bush to go ahead and say that certain kinds of stem cell lines and doing research with certain stem cell lines was okay. But I think that we also need to recognize that there's the research that's happening on the government level, and then there's research that happens by the private sector. And quite frankly, I think that cloning research is being done in various ways, various sections of the science. That it's happening at the private level, and it's not going to stop. They're trying to perfect this science and then think about what the social and ethical implications of it are after the fact. I would encourage us to do the thinking work before we get to that stage as a society.
So is there anything about cloning that you just kind of want to go off on that we haven't touched yet?
Well, you know, this issue of selection, I just think is a very interesting one. The degree to which we get to design who comes next. You know, we really have no idea if cloned individuals start reproducing either amongst themselves or with non-cloned folks. We don't really have a sense of what kinds of things lay in wait then for future generations. We don't know what kinds of weaknesses might be introduced into human populations. We don't know what kinds of strengths are possible. We don't know how it might provide a public goods for society that in fact benefits society. We don't really have a sense of what kind of great harm might result from cloning. You know, for me, because I'm interested in global health issues, all of the inequity that occurred, the kind of money they could spend on something like this, which at least at this stage of the game in terms of the science of it all is a fairly inefficient way to reproduce. You know, the good old fashioned way of reproduction is so much more efficient than this. You know, when you see how much money is being spent on it, and then you compare that to the fact that there's so many people in the world that don't even have clean drinking water. The inequity of all of that is really a bit hard for me to stomach. I think there's such a separation between the people that need clean drinking water and the folks who are doing, you know, human cloning. I'm not sure that those worlds would ever have conditions under which they would meet. But you know, for me, that those are the kinds of issues that society needs to address and say, is this really where we want all the brain power that we have at our disposal? Are these the kinds of problems that we as a society want to try to solve? Or are we going to look at a more basic level and look at the people that already exist on this planet and what actually needs to be done to make the world that we live in right now a more equitable place to live?
So let's say you get home today, right, and there's a message on your answering machine from President Bush, right, and he says, I don't know anything about cloning, right, I want to make a position for you in the White House that says, you know, cloning moral advisor, right, something like that. If you were going to give advice to the current administration about how to handle this, what would be some of the first things that you tell them? I know that kind of puts you on the spot.
Well, not really. I mean, you know, I've thought about this a lot. I've read a lot of what Bell Hooks has written, and she's, you know, when this whole thing came up, when Clarence Thomas came up and he was nominated to be a Supreme Court judge, and Anita Hill raised the issue of sexual harassment. You know, Bell Hooks wrote quite eloquently about how there need to be people in positions of power who have thought about the implications for women and for society at large. And you know, I always go back to Donna Haraway, this notion of there need to be people who care about science and technology, but not necessarily from the techie standpoint, which is where most of the people who are involved in these kinds of things come from, but from the standpoint of women's rights and women's reproductive freedoms and choices. And so often those kinds of issues just get lost in all this. We don't we don't think in terms of the implications either of gender, ethnicity, or class. And those would be the kinds of issues that I would want people, as they go forward with this, to pay attention to. And there's just not enough people, I don't think, in the current administration that pay attention to those kinds of things.
I mean, I feel like there's so much to say, but...
Do you want to talk about armies, hierarchies, slaves? I don't know that it's possible, actually, to create that, but...
They definitely did in the movies.
So what do you think about that? I mean, I would actually, ZT, I'm interested in knowing what you think in terms of kind of the public culture representations of cloning and how you see cloning as being important in kind of the public imaginary, what people imagine to be true about cloning and the kinds of things that we're at risk for if we develop the science further.
Well, you know, you want to kind of hear me go off on a tangent?
Yes, please.
Okay. I mean... And I feel bad because I don't know. I don't like to think of myself as a Star Wars geek, right? But
but you are. True confessions.
Yeah, maybe. Like, what was it? There's this quote I heard the other day, and it says, like, cool is going to the beach with your C-3PO Star Wars towel and still hitting on women. I don't know. Anyways,
you liked it.
Yeah, I thought it was kind of funny. That sort of struck me, at least about how this is represented in science fiction, which I guess is like the, you know, place where all this is going to start, because up until now, this at least has been science fiction, and it probably still is, by most accounts.
But if I can just interject here, I think you're raising a really interesting point, is that the way in which people... science fiction is a great vehicle for attending to people's... suspicions and fears of what might happen in the future from this kind of science.
Go ahead.
Yeah, just that I think that science fiction isn't so fiction in many cases, and there have been people who have written about the way in which science fiction sometimes comes true.
Because I know in at least the most recent Star Wars movie, there's a race of people, or at least the planet, where their only job is creating clones, right? Mm-hmm. And they create an army of living, breathing people, right? Who just, by whatever genetic tricks or whatever, they're completely obedient. And I guess you'd kind of like to think that, and maybe, you know, just because, like I said, Hollywood's probably, you know, Hollywood's biggest goal, of course, is to make money, right? But in a lot of movies, I haven't really seen any ethical issues about cloning really raised. In Star Wars, at least, Jedi are supposed to be this great peacekeeping force in the galaxy, right? And then find out that they have at their disposal, like, an army of however many thousands of clones, millions of clones, right? And they just go ahead and use them, and a lot of them die, and, well, I don't know.
But they are so expendable. Think, in that film, they're totally expendable.
Mm-hmm. And it's funny because, and I don't know if I'm going off on too much of a tangent, but the person that they clone to make this entire army... looks like he's of Mexican heritage.
Mm.
Kind of strange.
Why strange?
People definitely associate, at least in the United States, they associate immigrants, which are usually Mexicans, with sort of the labor culture in our society. You can pay them minimum wage and
it's, so you're saying that it's actually kind of keeping with the cultural paradigm that exists in the United States with regards to race, uh-huh?
Yeah, and... Yeah. I thought that was sort of interesting.
Mm-hmm. Unfortunate.
Unfortunate, even.
How was watching Star Wars? How did it play into what your notion of the clone, your notion of the clone as a human being, or the notion of the clone as a peon or a part of an army? Or what did it stimulate for you in terms of what you think is possible in societies when clones are around or amongst us?
Well, I mean, it's sort of something that you see repeated a lot, and not only in science fiction, but, you know, the idea that you want kind of a perfect homogenized soldier, right?
Uh-huh.
So what they do is they pick someone who's, you know, like, really good at, like, you know, being a soldier, I guess, mm-hmm. is one way to put it, like, killing people, whatever, like a bounty hunter, and then you make a bunch of him, right? And then they're perfectly
obedient. As if that can be genetically prescribed.
Yeah.
I don't happen to buy that it is.
I don't know.
Yeah. I happen to think that's environmental. Yeah.
And you can argue that it's acceptable in the military because, well, you know, you have to maintain some sort of chain of command and not where it's not necessarily the kind of situation, and I can understand their point for this. It's not really the kind of situation where you want to have a
free thinkers.
Yeah, a lot of free thinkers. You want people who are going to go and do their job and
right.
whatever. But I do think it's kind of, and especially with the way, you know, people are talking about war right now, and like you said before, you know, collateral damage of these, you know, clones who will be born, if they're possibly disabled. You know, a lot of people just say, oh, well, you know, the last time we were in Iraq, only 200 people died. And to me, it just sort of seems like it's perpetuating this idea that sort of armchair view, the sort of distant, aloof view. And I'm not a historian or anything, but one of the things I've seen in a lot of situations when countries go to war is that it's not really the people who want to go to war. It's really more the leaders who want to go to war.
Mm-hmm.
I think the people very much understand that, you know, the guy who's in the military is, you know, the guy they went to high school with or the, you know, their roommate in college. And, you know, that person is going to die. It's not going to be, you know, one out of however many 300 or 400 Americans who die in Iraq. It's going to be a friend.
Right.
And I think the upper class who sit around watching CNN and punch in their calculator as well, this is what the cost is going to be, they don't really understand that. And
or in fact, they might be investing in it.
Right. I think it's a bigger problem where people just don't, I don't know, that people are people. And, you know, just because you're rich, or just because you're affluent, or just because you're in a place in society where you don't have to worry about going to war because you can buy your way out or run off to Canada or something. You know, there's people that are going to.
Well, you're basically talking about empowered and disempowered people and how cloning then may make all of that even more complicated, that it,
right.
that the kinds of distinctions that we see that get made really regularly around the world between people who are different from one another, this adds another very potentially explosive aspect of difference that, well, how are we going to negotiate it as a human population?
Right, definitely.
The other piece of this is you know people have long sought immortality, right? And this is just one more means by which you can avoid death, or at least that's what's held out as the promise. Now, whether or not it's really going to reduce human pain, suffering, and ultimately death remains to be seen. But should we really be going to such extent to avoid death? Isn't there something... Do we need to totally reconfigure our notion of what it means to be human so that it doesn't include death? Or... I think the specter of death is what a lot of people want to avoid with this notion of cloning themselves, is that they will never die. It's why people have biological children in many cases, because an extension of themselves that will go on long after their death. Well, what about just acknowledging that people die?
That's actually maybe another interesting point. As a cultural anthropologist, do you see other cultures around the world being more
accepting of death?
Accepting of death than we are in the United States?
Without question.
What would be some of the examples?
Well, I lived in Sierra Leone. It's in West Africa for 2 years. And, of course, there's a lot more death in Sierra Leone. But there's an acceptance. There's a more everydayness of death that, in fact, of course, many people in this culture would find completely unacceptable. And yet, to come in contact with that kind of fragility of life is a real... For me, it was, as an American who expects to live a very long time, there was something incredibly true and humbling about the fact that we're vulnerable to death all the time, and that the people that we love may die. And to distance yourself from death, either the big ones where people... aren't there anymore, or the small kinds of everyday deaths of disappointments and things and dreams that didn't ever come to fruition.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as a society, we really don't handle those kinds of disappointments or griefs very well. And I think that there are societies that do a much better job at that aspect of what it means to be human than we do.
Can you speak to a little bit about how they handle it differently, or the circumstances surrounding it?
Grieving is much more public. The assumption is when that people, the assumption is that people will die, that children will die, that it's not necessarily a death out of order the way that we think of children dying here, that only the strong survive, that spirits actually can get vexed and make you sick in a way that make you die. You know, there's the notion there's a much more integrated notion in many places of kind of the mental aspects that can lead to sickness and sometimes death than here. You know, the body-mind thing is considered still alternative. I think in other cultures it's an accepted part that they're not separate. I mean, I could go on and on here.
Well, I guess maybe another way to put it is, why do you feel the United States has a fascination with immortality?
Because we believe that all things are possible, so why not ourselves living forever? I do see it as a cultural thing that we do here, an assumption that we make that goes in many cases unquestioned, that we have the right to that. Often at the expense of others. I mean, look at the way we live, huh?
That's true.
The way that we consume so much of the world's resources, and you know, we're only 5% of the world's population. I mean, we actually act as if we do have a right to live forever at the expense of other people's. So actually, the cloning thing is very much in keeping with that.
Yeah, it's very much like a phenomenon of fooling cultures. I mean, there's a lot of things I notice about the United States where it's like the only reason you can afford to worry about these kinds of things is because, like, you're rich or because you're at least more affluent than other places.
Or because you're not drinking water every morning when you wake up that has bugs in it that are going to make you need to sit on the toilet all day.
Right.
Well, you can't blame people.
Really. Yeah.
You know, short of going to live in these places, it's really hard for Americans to ever be put in, most Americans anyway, not all Americans, but most Americans, it's very hard for Americans to imagine what it's like to not have access when you wake up every morning to clean water or good sanitation, or, you know, not walking outside their house and having to step over sick people, or not having proper sewage and things like that, the things that actually can make you quite ill and susceptible to death quite quickly.
Such a happy interview.
You can count on me.
Right. So much to talk about. Is there anything else you'd like to go off on?
ZT, do you want to clone yourself?
I guess I haven't really thought about it.
If the technology was available, would you do it?
I don't know. I mean, my girlfriend has this... She's very afraid of death. I'd almost sort of call it like a personality disorder. Right? And she just doesn't like me to bring it up at all. And I don't know. Like, I definitely don't want to die. It's not something that maybe someday I will if I'm really, really sick. I don't know. I mean, I'm just... No, I don't. I have no interest in cloning myself. Maybe someday I will, just for...
So if you die, would she clone you?
I hope not. Yeah, no, I don't want to be cloned. There's...
Well, see, this is a very interesting issue, you know, because some of the kinds of things that have happened as a result of reproductive technologies, for example, I don't know if you've heard of the electro-ejaculation process... otherwise written about by Laurie Andrews as the Sperminator.
Oh, is that where you can extract sperm from men after
they've
postmortem?
Yes.
Yeah.
After they've died. Yeah. It's a cattle prod kind of tool that's actually inserted in the rectum to make the man ejaculate. And there have been cases in which there have been parents of only sons who have had this process done to their sons and then inserted the sperm into surrogate women and have had grandchildren as a result of this. So you know, this whole, all of these technologies actually raise the issue of both property rights, so that should you die and your girlfriend can't stand this notion, then who knows what might happen to any of your bodily materials. Anyway, all these things are possible now.
Maybe you just kind of have to make sure to clean your pipes out before you die. Otherwise, you never know what's going to happen. Huh. Yeah, no, I don't want to be cloned. I'm content changing the world in other ways. That's what I'm going to work towards. Besides, I don't have the money to do it anyway, so.
Be sure to get it all in your will.
Anything else you want to say?
No, just that in signing off, I'd want to encourage people to really think about where their own boundaries fall in terms of cloning, whether they'd ever do it, what they see as possible problems, what they think the larger social implications and the larger global implications of this particular kind of science, what are these implications for humankind?
So one of the things I like to ask all the people I interview is if you have a request for a song.
How about Weird Al Yankovic, if that's how you pronounce his last name?
I think so.
I think I'm a clone now.
Okay. And you've been listening to ZT talking with Professor Susan Erickson of the University of Colorado at Boulder, cultural anthropologist.